I've seen this movie before. That one ends in tears. I can tell you exactly what happened.
It's early days.
They don't get it, and they don't seem to care.
Let's stop being delicate little flowers and have a proper debate.
A government that is bitterly divided.
We've got to raise the standards of journalism a little bit here.
I'm Patricia Carvelis from RN Drive.
And I'm Raf Epstein from ABC Radio Melbourne.
And thanks for being here, Raf, because you are my co-host while Fran is away. And after this episode, just a little announcement, you won't be hearing from us for a couple of weeks. We're taking a little break and we'll be back in your podcast feed in October. Don't worry, we will be back.
The big theme of the week, if you think same-sex marriage is the catnip of Australian politics, the crack cocaine of Australian politics, is energy, right? This is the thing that energises people more than anything else. It has toppled numerous leaders and it continues to leave the government struggling for a policy. They haven't yet settled on how they're going to divide up the carrots and the sticks. Low emissions future, who do you reward, who do you punish? There's this energy target being set by the chief energy scientist. Put all of the expertise aside, it all has come down to one plant in one state, the Liddell power plant in the Hunter Valley. We spoke about it in the last podcast as the crappy clunker of power stations. Yet again, the CEO of AGL was hauled in for a meeting with the Prime Minister and the Energy Minister. And yes, he gave in. He's going to take a proposal to the board. This does not sound like a man willing to sell or spend more on the Liddell Power Station.
We are committed to finding the best solution for the market. We believe that we can deliver that without having to consider the extension or sell the plant, and that's what we're going to work on.
Yeah, and Liberal backbencher Craig Kelly accused AGL of being duplicitous in this idea that they're, you know, double speak. So they put out that statement, as you say, after that meeting, saying that in 90 days they're going to come up with a proposal to either, you know, keep the plant open, to sell it, or deliver equivalent power into the market. And that is the crucial part. And that,
although can I be tougher than you were?
Tougher than me?
AGL were pretty clear. They used the word closure many times. What they did commit to, they'll go to the board and say, hey, by the way, the government would like you to do this. But why would a board say yes when the CEO is saying no?
It gave the government enough, Raf, politically, to say, well, they are taking it back to the board. So clearly we're still in the hunt on this issue. And the Prime Minister is really, I've been told by senior people in the government that, you know, they've had to take him kicking and screaming to this position of recalibrating this clean energy target, this proposal, the 50th recommendation from Alan Finkel, the chief scientist.
And in fact, when I had Josh Frydenberg, the energy minister, on, I asked him to repeat the Prime Minister's words, which were essentially in June, Malcolm Turnbull said, and this goes direct to your kicking and screaming, he said it has a lot of virtues. It will work. It's got really very many strong virtues. I asked Josh Frydenberg that three times, just simply to repeat what the Prime Minister had said. He didn't, because they've got to appease those in their party who want to give carrots to new and old coal.
The clean energy target effectively faces being renamed and also redesigned fundamentally differently to what's been recommended.
Well, allowing, listen to the experts, PK.
Well, allowing so-called clean coal to access government subsidies. I get 7,000 emails and messages a day. I am exaggerating, but I do get many saying, don't call it clean coal. Well, this is the language the government's using. A revised scheme, it might allow high-efficiency, low-emission coal-fired power plants to receive these partial certificates or credits under this clean energy scheme.
Carrots.
You know how we think, you know, Labor had the olive branch about the 50th Finkel recommendation. You know, we're willing to consider it. And it looked for a moment, Raf, like we might get a bipartisan position on
energy.
You're
such a glass half full kind
of
woman,
aren't you? But it did. There was a moment. It was such a brief moment. I'm owning that. Very brief. But there was a moment. Maybe. And, of course, that quote from the Prime Minister, perhaps. I have been told by people in the government, they don't want a compromise. They don't want Labor to agree. They don't want to come to a position where they all agree, kumbaya, we're all agreeing, this is the parliament. They actually want to keep the division here. I want to make this really clear, because they think if there is a division, they can really hammer Labor on energy prices, on Labor being too out there, too obsessed with renewable energy. And this is their focus. They actually don't want a deal.
Why isn't the party of Labor standing up for Laborers?
Many people do not want a deal in the coalition, a bipartisan position. They want to keep the politics in this. They want to go to the next election campaigning around divisions on this issue.
Oliver Yates said something really interesting. He ran one of the big renewable energy agencies, did run for Liberal pre-selection in New South Wales, but ran one of the big green funds appointed by Labor. Well, this is what he told Sabre Lane on AM.
The concept of changing the clean energy target to something like a dirty energy target, almost inverse of it, is the type of polarisation we have in the debate.
The dirty energy target. Oliver Yates there. But the other big news, PK, I don't know if the Prime Minister will get any credit for this. He'd landed a whopper on education. Simon Birmingham delivered him that. Mitch Fifield, his communications minister, looks like he's really delivered another big fish.
Yeah, after weeks of negotiations, the coalition has now won support for its media changes, and they're really substantial changes. They include scrapping the 2 out of 3 rule. It prevents a company owning a TV station, a radio station, and a newspaper in the same licence area. And the communications minister, Mitch Fifield, is claiming a win. We're recording this on a Thursday morning. It is likely to pass today. The deal is done. Essentially, the Nick Xenophon team. What they've secured is a fund for regional and small publishers. It's worth $60.4 million. Also, Senator Xenophon's deal includes an ACCC-style inquiry into the impact of platforms like Google and Facebook on the media industry. Now, I spoke to Greens leader Richard Di Natale. The Greens and Labor are very opposed to this. He said it would be a concentration of media, that it would ruin media diversity, that it's a very bad deal. And, of course, questions around the ABC and the other side deal that's been done with One Nation around the ABC, publishing salaries and putting fair and balanced into the legislation.
I've got so much to say about fair and balanced. But look, let's separate it out. So the deal they've made with Nick Xenophon, don't forget, Mitch Fifield got every single media company in the country to agree to it and got all of the votes in the Senate. That is a significant achievement. Maybe the Greens are right. It reduces diversity. Maybe the government's right. It strengthens the media. Either way, they've got that through. Separate to that, as you say, is what One Nation wants. And there are two big things. The one that won't happen is putting something like fair and balanced into the ABC's legislation. I don't think, we know, Nick Xenophon is not going to go down that path. The one inquiry that probably can happen, and I think Richard Di Natale acknowledged this with you, they're going to look at what's called competitive neutrality. Should the ABC be in a digital space? Can the ABC spend money on Google search terms? Richard Di Natale, I know with you, was raising the prospect of having to pay for iView.
Paywalls,
and those sorts of things. That will be a huge issue for the ABC, whether or not it affects, and the SBS, whether or not it affects other media organisations in the future, I doubt it.
That's right. And the other thing that's happened this week, what I just want to make mention of, the government's anti-vilification laws, which are designed to put safeguards during that postal survey, have passed the parliament. I think this is actually quite significant. We saw for the first time in a very ugly and divisive debate between also, and very partisan I find, between Labor and the coalition, a different tone.
$12,000 for intimidating or vilifying someone. That's a big thing to agree on.
$12,600 if they are found to vilify, intimidate or threaten harm on the basis of sexual orientation, gender identity, intersex status or religion.
What is really amazing, given, I mean, the venom that gets spat at either side of the dispatch box. And there is Labor saying, yeah, you know what? It is totally fine with me to have the Attorney General, George Brandis, being the gatekeeper on whether or not someone gets charged with or hit with a fine that could be $12,000. So whether or not you think that's a good idea or a bad idea, whether or not it's drastically different to some state-based laws, that's just amazing. It's like this little oasis.
I know.
In a sea of partisan acrimony, you've got Draper saying, you know what, George? You've got our back. That is amazing.
I interviewed Mark Dreyfus this week about it. He's Shadow Attorney General in Labor, and I usually find him quite, you know, he's not afraid of criticising the government, I'll say. But he was just so, you know, he said such nice things about the government. No, we've been working really well on this, and I think they're coming to a good position on this. And I was like, wow, I don't have interviews like that very often. So I thought, well, there you go. This one little thing that's happening. I will be very interested to see if anyone gets slapped with any of these fines.
Every politician I asked about it said, we hope that it will not have to be used.
Mark Dreyfus did say one thing. He said, you can't police it all. That's the truth. You know, we can't pretend that everyone's going to be safe. But it does send a message, and I think that's true. Hey, should we bring our guest in?
Let's do it. He for me, our guest had the mic drop moment of commentary for the week. David Crowe, political correspondent for The Australian.
Welcome to our humble podcast. David, would you like a drink?
Love one, thank you.
I know. I'm going to make you... the only drink I actually like to make is a pina colada.
Pina colada?
A high-energy one, I think, is what we need.
Oh, very good, David. Very good. High-energy, low emissions.
Let's move on before we go any further into that.
All right, let's start with AGL. Obviously, it was we've already touched on this at the beginning of the podcast, but, you know, we had this kind of double speak, so says the backbench of the coalition from the AGL boss, David. What do you make of it? Is AGL really going to sell this thing?
I think it looks really difficult for them because I think they make a lot more profit if they close it down and then use the neighbouring coal-fired power station, which they also own, to extract more profit from the grid. And look, they're a profit-making enterprise. Their business is to make more money. And reliability is not one of their KPIs for shareholders. Their dividend has gone up quite handsomely over the last 10 years. And I think the only way that they can be encouraged to make energy more reliable by maybe keeping it running for a bit longer or coming up with a better plan is by regulation. And that's the name of the game this week has been get tough on AGL.
David, the mic drop moment of the week for me in reading commentary was your line earlier in the week when you said that, I mean, the government's got real chutzpah. How can the government expect AGL to decide on new generators if the government can't decide on a clean energy target? I mean, it's both outrageous, isn't it? And also, it's tough. How does AGL make a decision if they don't know what the future is?
Yeah, now their accountants are going to be running the numbers on what the viability is of keeping it open, selling it off, installing new gas-fired, what's called peaking gas to fill gaps in the market. How do you make those investment decisions if you don't know what the ground rules are going to be in 2022, 23, 24? And that's why the government's own indecision is its biggest liability in this debate. It can get tough on Andy Veazey. It can attack Bill Shorten over having an ambitious renewables target. It can try and defend itself on prices, but it's always got a weak foundation all the way through until it decides on a clean energy target. At the moment, I think it's slowly waking up to the realisation that it's got to reset expectations about this, possibly not have a clean energy target or have a different scheme with a different name that won't carry so much baggage.
But David, with this whole debate around Liddell, and it's been this power plant that's been the focus of the debate, and, you know, so much kind of bashing up on AGL as well. Obviously, the government's trying to extract maximum politics out of this. I mean, no one's going to be surprised that listens to this podcast that that's what, you know, politicians do. But I get the sense when you mention what they're trying to do with the set, with the, you know, clean energy target, that they want to keep the politics in this. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, I do. I see it that way after this week, especially when they've been attacking. There's been no discussion about a clean energy target. Nobody in the government actually uses that phrase unless they're asked about it by a journalist or challenged on it in Parliament. It's just not the phrase they want to use. It's all about reliability. And I don't think that there is a rational calculation on the government side now that says, let's try to get a bipartisan agreement on what Alan Finkel recommended in June with his clean energy target. I think they're rapidly moving on from that. And I don't think it's just about backbenchers being anxious about what they do. I think it's about a fairly cold political calculation by ministers and by Malcolm Turnbull about the reality of what they've got to achieve.
David, I just wonder where you think, let's wind this out a little bit, where we are with experts. It's taken us, I don't know how many years, to implement the Gonski review. It's not perfect. Labor would spend a lot more money, but at least it's a better mechanism. I don't know how many years that took. The government asked Alan Finkel what to do. When are they going to start listening to the experts?
I think they've moved beyond that report. It's the story of the year, really, is that they started a discussion about energy. They were waiting for Finkel to give them some advice. When they got it, they decided they needed to go to the energy market operator to get different advice about the shortages to come. And that's what they're going to act on. In a funny kind of way, I think Alan Finkel's report could actually end up giving Labor a blueprint for what it may do. And then we'll see that contest at the next election. It doesn't mean the government's walking away from all of Finkel, but the clean energy target is just
the main bit they're walking away from.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge recommendation. They're not going to adopt it. They'll adopt some other measure that I think they'll argue will create some investment certainty, but it'll have reliability of the electricity grid as a priority.
How about just a Liberal government, a Liberal Prime Minister, telling businesses how to run their business? Like, that's really, sorry, but I'm just going to call it out. That's really weird, isn't it, David?
And it is also the result of the government now waking up to something that voters would have expected them to wake up to in 2014, that there was going to be a shortage, that maybe some ground rules would be needed. And the coalition didn't do that. So they're inheriting the consequences of their own inaction in the past, thinking, for instance, that abolishing the carbon tax was going to be the solution to everything. Now, there's one argument for the intervention. I think that what's been happening in the electricity market over a long time now is the outsourcing of decisions to regulators managing this national electricity market, the East Coast grid. Sooner or later, people can't keep outsourcing it to the grid, thinking the grid's going to look after itself. It is interventionist, but the point is to keep electricity flowing in a reliable way. And I don't see any other option for the government now, given that what we saw with Hazelwood earlier this year in Victoria was that everybody stood back and said, look, let the market look after itself. Let the coal-fired power station close down. Now they're dealing with the consequences of shortages and higher prices being predicted. So I think that the response to Liddell is rational, given the experience of what happened with the laissez-faire approach to Hazelwood earlier this year.
And back to the politics. We do policy and politics here, but there's a lot of politics in everything. And I've spoken to some, front benchers, back benchers, people. I'm sure you do too, David, all the time. That's your job. And they're really happy that they're talking about energy all week. They felt like there was too much of a focus on the other issues. And even if there's a contest, and I'm sure there's some areas where they're not necessarily always looking good, when they're talking about this issue, they think this is a good thing for them. Are they right?
I think they are right. Although I sit in question time and wonder why the government doesn't have better answers. Why did the government not know that Labor's going to ask a simple question, do you support a clean energy target or not? And then come up with a compelling answer that tells people where they're going.
Let's circle back to same-sex marriage, because this week the survey is being sent out. Have you got yours, David, yet?
Yeah, I did. Uh-huh. Haven't filled it in yet, though. Planning to have a family moment where we fill it in.
Are you up with the family?
Yeah, get the family together. Well, my daughter's 16. She can't vote yet, but I wanted to be there when we fill it in.
What are you going to write? Are you willing to reveal?
Oh, yeah, I'm going to say yes. I think my wife will say yes, and I think my daughter would say yes.
This week we had a bit of a debate about respectful debate and new laws around all of this. And then Matt Canavan, he used to be a minister, he's on the way to the High Court, but he had this to say.
Can't we just all grow a spine and grow up? I mean, the debate hasn't been that bad. Indeed, if there's any complaints to be had, it's from those that advocate yes, some of the vile tweets and statements we've heard from yes campaigners. But look, I can ignore that. I mean, let's stop being delicate little flowers and have a proper debate.
Delicate little flowers. What did you think of that, David Crowe?
Oh, I thought it was unfortunate. I think it's just, well, it's wrong too. You know, there's a lot of animosity towards gay people, and it does emerge during a debate like this. And I think that is the experience of anybody who knows anybody who's gay, right? You know that they cop it. So it's just the wrong way to approach the debate. The funny thing is that the opponents of the laws that have been put to Parliament this week to sort of govern the way the debate's been run on same-sex marriage, those laws are being opposed by the people on the no case because they think that, you know, how dare we shut down free speech? I think there are lots of inconsistencies in all the arguments, especially from the no case this week.
Imagine if in the middle of the 18C debate the government was having in their party room, the Attorney General popped up and said, oh, by the way, we're going to introduce a new law, which I'm in charge of, where you'll cop up to a $12,000 fine for intimidating or vilifying someone. I mean, it just would have, the party room would have exploded. Yet that's just kind of slipped under the radar in the midst of a debate about energy and whether or not people are getting their survey form.
I was surprised at the $12,000 civil penalty and also at the discretion that's given to the Attorney General to basically decide whether somebody's going to be prosecuted or not. So I can see cases coming up where something happens in the debate and then there's incredible pressure on George Brandis from the coalition party room, or perhaps from the conservative side of the coalition party room, maybe from the moderate side, for him to take action. And then it turns every instance into a bigger political argument within the coalition over what to do about it. That may be something that they come to regret, depending on how the debate's going to play out.
It's interesting, you know, the whole grow a spine, you know, robust debate. Of course, I'm a big fan of free speech, and I think we should be having robust debate, but I also think we need to acknowledge reality. And you said it, David, but if you're a young gay person in maybe a rural, remote area, and an entire debate's going on, which isn't confined to marriage, is in many cases, if you listen to some advocates, also about your legitimacy as a human being. If you're saying that that makes you, you know, you're a bit soft for not being able to hear that and not having it hurt you or not having an impact on your idea about how you see yourself, I think that's delusional. And I think we owe it to young people to call that sort of stuff out. I'm glad the government is, actually. That's what's happening here, isn't it?
Yeah, well said. And it's that dismissive attitude that I think is just the completely wrong way to approach the debate. One other thing that I thought was very interesting this week is the argument about same-sex marriage from the no side has been turned into this deep concern about religious freedom. And yet when two of the main proponents for the no case, Lyle Shelton and Katrina Ocotel, were at the press club this week, they were asked, well, what happens if that religious freedom may be legislated and is then used by somebody of Muslim faith to deny a service to somebody on some grounds, or any faith for that matter? They didn't actually have an answer. And this is the interesting thing that's emerging. The no case doesn't actually want to say how they would legislate religious freedom. It's a concern for them in this debate, but they won't reveal how they may modify a same-sex marriage private members bill in order to fix the concerns that they've got. I don't know how they would actually legislate that protection for religious freedom without going too far. It's actually a big part of the debate that I think is yet to come.
David, you've been a great guest, a former colleague of mine when I used to work at The Australian, and now a podcast.
What great days.
Yeah, all the heady days. And now a podcast buddy. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Every week I listen to The Party Room, and PK and Fran trade preferences. They talk about the thing that caught their eye, that entertained them. Such a privilege to be able to share what I think was funny. But PK, let's start with you.
Okay, I'm just going to play it first. Here it is.
You know that 10% of New South Wales power comes from Liddell. You know that these energy companies are making record profits on the back of Australian families. You know, how important it is to keep jobs in the Hunter Valley.
You know,
and so don't be no-clock job.
You come up to the Hunter next week.
Can I just
I'll introduce you to some of my power station workers.
So that's in the press gallery. Joel's just come out of, I think that was just after he actually spoke to me on RM Breakfast in the morning. He made that claim that really AGL had been bullied by the government. And then he ran into Josh,
Mr. Frydenberg,
who is the Energy and Environment Minister, and they have what I think is such an awkward exchange.
So let me ask you, they have huge smiles on their faces while they're having this altercation. And in fact, they have the argument and then they continue that argument while they're walking down the corridor.
Yeah, because they're tough guys.
So are they enjoying it? Or do they think it's a good thing, or are they in a place and they get trapped and they sort of fall down a rabbit hole they don't want to be in?
Rabbit hole, absolutely. Right. It's a massive tough guy moment. That's how I saw it. Sorry, it was just like, no, my position's better than yours, Josh. No, Joel. It's like a Boise.
You're not saying male aggression's overtaking the space of Australian politics, are you?
Oh, look, I would never say that. No. You know me, Raph. I would never think or say that. Ever. Hashtag never. What's your trading preference?
Hey, look, my trading preference. Okay. The FM radio offensive is on. Normally it's a sign that an election is imminent. You cannot keep Bill Shorten and Malcolm Turnbull away from a group of highly paid comedians and shock jocks, but especially on commercial FM. However, when you're asked a pop culture question on one of these shows, normally you are self-deprecating.
If you were the characters in Game of Thrones, who would you be and who would the Prime Minister be?
I'd be Jon Snow.
Hang on. I don't watch this show. Doesn't he get killed off, Bill? That's not a good sign, is it?
What about the Prime Minister? Is he the Ice Dragon?
Is he the King of the White Walkers?
He did pretty well on, you can say that your political enemy is the baddie, but calling yourself the most attractive person who happens to, by the way, spoiler alert, who happens to come back from the dead, the sort of thing you should not do on the radio, and that is exactly what Bill Shorten was doing.
I'm actually not as convinced that it was a bad thing.
No?
Who doesn't want to be, like, everyone wants to be Jon Snow.
Oh, he's being normal, right?
Because
we all
hot.
Want to be Jon.
Okay. Have you seen Jon Snow?
Yeah, no, he's
right.
Hot.
He's hot.
Yeah, he's hot. Okay. So he's being honest, and he's saying what any
He wants to be hot. Who doesn't want to be hot? Okay.
Okay. Oh, no, you've changed my mind.
Sadly, we've reached that time again. It's time to end this episode. This podcast is also going on a short break for the next few weeks. We'll be back to share our perspectives on the political scheming taking place in Parliament House. Until then, stay in touch. Tweet us using the hashtag ThePartyRoom or send us an email. We love emails. Send them to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
And don't forget, give us a review. Go to the iTunes store. Leave a review. That helps other people find this podcast. So if you think it's good, you leave a review there. Other people will hear about us.
And don't forget, while we're away, you can hear more political analysis and interviews on RN Breakfast at 6 a.m, RN Drive, 6 p.m. Of course, local radio, ABC Melbourne, every Arvo, 3 p.m. And of course, there's the ABC Listen app, so you can just listen to anything you like, right?
All the time, anywhere, anytime.
I love that.
It's like the old-fashioned transistor radio in your pocket.
See you, Raph.
See you later, Pete. Cage Beanfire.